areas that go through Acts, we read Acts
24 and Acts 25. To avoid disappointment later on, there is so much in Acts 24 that really I'm going to be speaking from Acts 24 and just a little reference to Acts 25. Because in a way, Acts 25 continues some of the themes from Acts 24. So I'm going to read to you Acts 24. 5 days later, the high priest Ananias went down to Caesarea with some of the elders and a lawyer named Tertullus, and they brought their charges against Paul before the governor. When Paul was called in, Tertullus presented his case before Felix. "We've enjoyed a long period of peace under you, and your foresight has brought about reforms in this nation. Everywhere and in every way, O most excellent Felix, we acknowledge this with profound gratitude. But in order not to weary you further, I would request that you be kind enough to hear us briefly." You get the idea of what sort of guy Tertullus was. "We have found this man to be a troublemaker, stirring up riots among the Jews all over the world. He is a ringleader of the Nazarene sect and even tried to desecrate the temple, so we seized him. By examining him yourself, you will be able to learn the truth about all these charges we are bringing against him." The Jews joined in the accusation, asserting that these things were true. When the governor motioned for him to speak, Paul replied, "I know that for a number of years you have been a judge over this nation, so I gladly make my defense. You can easily verify that no more than 12 days ago I went up to Jerusalem to worship. My accusers did not find me arguing with anyone at the temple or stirring up a crowd in the synagogue or anywhere else in the city. And I cannot prove to you the charges they are now making against me. However, I admit that I do worship the God of our fathers as a follower of the way, which they call a sect. I believe everything that agrees with the law and that is written in the prophets. And I have the same hope in God as these men, that there will be a resurrection of both the righteous and the wicked. So I strive always to keep my conscience clear before both God and man. After an absence of several years, I came to Jerusalem to bring my people gifts for the poor and to present offerings. I was ceremonially clean when they found me in the temple courts doing this. There was no crowd with me, nor was I involved in any disturbance. But there are some Jews in the province of Asia who ought to be here before you and bring charges if they have anything against me. Or these who are here should state what crime they found in me when I stood before the Sanhedrin. Unless it was this one thing I shouted as I stood in their presence. It is concerning the resurrection of the dead that I am on trial before you today." Then Felix, who was well acquainted with the way, adjourned the proceedings. "When Lysias, a commander, comes," he said, "I will decide your case." He ordered the centurion to keep Paul under guard, but to give him some freedom and permit his friends to take care of his needs. Several days later, Felix came with his wife Drusilla, who was a Jewess. He sent for Paul and listened to him, and he spoke about faith in Christ Jesus. As Paul discoursed on righteousness, self-control, and the judgment to come, Felix was afraid, and he said, "That's enough for now. You may leave. When I find it convenient, I'll send for you." At the same time, he was hoping that Paul would offer him a bribe, so he sent for him frequently and talked with him. When 2 years had passed, Felix was succeeded by Porcius Festus. But because Felix wanted to grant a favour to the Jews, he left Paul in prison. So let's quickly recap on the setting. How did we get to this place where Paul was on trial before the governor Felix in Caesarea? So for some while now, Paul's heart and Paul's spirit had been resting on the promises of God, and his heart was set towards Jerusalem and then to Rome. And as Paul came closer to Rome, many people warned him that there would be trouble ahead. Now, if that hasn't put a song in your mind, I don't know what will. There will be trouble ahead. So they warned him that there would be trouble ahead. But despite these warnings, Paul stuck firm to the promise, and he ended up in Jerusalem. And in Jerusalem, there he was worshipping, following the ways of Judaism, despite being a follower of the way. He was still doing everything according to Jewish practice and Jewish law and being very careful in that respect. His actions were either misinterpreted or deliberately misunderstood. And he was arrested and brought before the Roman commander, Claudius Lysias. Claudius Lysias, quickly learning that Paul was a Roman citizen, and perhaps thinking that he was a bit of a hot potato, decided it was above his pay grade to deal with Paul in the way that Ananias the high priest wanted him to in Jerusalem. So he thought, I know, I'll move it up the line. I'll make it somebody else's problem, and I'll send him to Caesarea, and Governor Felix can sort this out. So he packed Paul off to Caesarea, which was even further away from where Paul wanted to be in Rome, under guard in case anything happened. And so Paul finds himself on trial in front of the Roman governor, and this whole courtroom drama unfolds. Now, if you read it on the page, even though I tried to put a little bit of characterization in there, it can seem a bit flat and a bit dry. But to me, this really comes alive when you think of the four people that Paul was up against. So let's briefly have a look at these. So Ananias was the high priest, and he decided to go to Caesarea to add weight to the case against Paul. He was the highest of the high, probably frustrated by the fact that the job that he wanted done in Jerusalem wasn't seen through to the conclusion that he wanted. He wanted Paul dead, out of the picture, once and for all. That was the whole point of what went on in Jerusalem. So now he goes to Caesarea to make sure that this job gets done, to add weight to the case. He takes with him some Jewish elders, so you can imagine there's a whole group of them in their finery, exuding the power, exuding power before them, all arrayed up behind Paul. But also, he goes tooled up with a lawyer named Tertullus. He wasn't going to leave anything to chance. Now, Tertullus was apparently one of the most skilled legal experts of their age. He had a good reputation. It was a bit like hiring Cherie Blair to defend 3 points on your driving license. It was kind of like really going over the top, the best of the best to argue their case. Tertullus was an expert, apparently, in Roman law, so he could understand how Felix should work and could work. He was also a bit of an expert in Judaism, so he could present the case from Ananias' side. He also was a bit of a friend of Felix, and he had a reputation for having a way with words, being something of a silver-tongued wordsmith. So you can see that Ananias is stacking all of the cards up against Paul. This should be a done deal. So whatever else he was, Tertullus could spin words before Felix and play into his ego, into his good side, and smarming his way into his good books. His speech was, "Oh Felix, you totally amazing person. We've flourished under your rule. You are the best of the best, the fairest of the fair." We didn't quite say that, but you get the idea, playing into his ego. Well, Felix was a real piece of work. Felix was actually born as a servant and has worked his way up into a position of power, initially based on the standing of his brother in court. So Felix was somebody who had risen to power not on his own strength, but through devious means. He's risen to power on the back of the coattails of other people rather than who he was. He was apparently incredibly greedy. He was open to bribes, and we can see that later on in Acts 24 when he says he was holding on to Paul, hoping that some of this money that Paul had spoken about that he brought into Jerusalem would actually come his way. So he's hoping to profit out of this. But apparently he was also incredibly ruthless in putting down any insurgency and rebellion. Historians would say that he was one of the most cruelest and depraved people of his time. He'd also advanced himself through marriage. Over the course of his life, up to this point, he'd had 3 wives, and each of those wives took him 1 step further to the center of power. And his current wife was Drusilla, 16-year-old, and was the youngest daughter of Herod Agrippa I. At age 15, Drusilla was married to somebody else. But this person wasn't good enough for Drusilla, so she left him and married Felix 1 year later. So here was somebody who was trying to advance her position. It says she was a Jewess, but trying to advance her position by means of marrying into power. So we have this idea that there's a relationship between Felix and Drusilla that was based on his lust for a younger woman and her greed for money and power. Apparently, Drusilla's son actually died in the eruption of Vesuvius in AD 79. I love these little bits because it kind of puts the Bible in the historical context that many of us could have might know about. So we have Ananias with his silver-tongued lyre, and he must have fancied his chances with Tertullus, best person he could have, up against Felix, corrupt and greedy, with a history of destroying troublesome people by putting them to death by crucifixion, and with his wife kind of egging him on. Surely pronouncing the death of Paul would happen in a matter of days. It was a done deal. We know, because we've read the rest of the chapter, that things didn't quite turn out that way. So let's look at the charges that Tertullus brought. After playing into the ego of Felix, Tertullus essentially said there's three things. This man, Paul, causes riots amongst the Jews wherever he goes. He is a real troublemaker. Trouble seems to follow him around. Not only that, he's actually a ringleader of a troublesome sect. And using that word sect was deliberately wiring into Felix as a governor and his concerns that sects around the place would raise up and threaten the Roman peace. And then thirdly, Paul tried to bring a Gentile into the forbidden part of the temple. So the basic thrust of Tertullus's prosecution is this. This is not a matter of religion, primarily, Felix. This is a matter of politics. Here is somebody who threatens Pax Romana. Here is somebody who threatens Roman peace and Roman rule. And you, Felix, as governor of this region, you are responsible for Pax Romana. You are responsible for making sure that there is peace. So in this political way, you can ensure peace and get rid of this troublemaker, and the riots will calm down, and you will be praised for it, and you will be lauded for it. And by the way, at the same time, you'll also make some friends amongst Ananias and his kind. That was the essence of Tertullus's charges. And in order to make his point, Tertullus embellished what had happened in Jerusalem far beyond the reality of events. So let's look at Paul's defense. Paul is standing there in front of Felix alone. He didn't bring his friends with him. He didn't have a lawyer with him. The normal course of action at this point would have been for Felix to cross-examine Paul and ask him questions and draw out of Paul his defense. But interestingly, Felix didn't do that. He just allowed Paul to stand up and defend himself and say what he wanted to say. This is kind of, if you like, a classic case of somebody speaking truth to power. So in contrast to the flattery of Tertullus, Paul is polite, positive, and honest. He quickly dismisses the charges before him. And this is his defense. Come on. It's less than a fortnight since all this happened and since I arrived in Jerusalem. I've not really had the time to organize a riot and organize a revolt. I'm not the ringleader of anything. I was just worshiping on my own in the temple, peacefully, not inciting anyone. As for desecrating the temple, there is no proof. But what I will admit to is I am a follower of the way. But I was in Jerusalem to distribute money to the poor and to worship at the Feast of Pentecost. The point of his defense was to turn it around and say to Felix, look, this is not political. This is a matter of religion. This is not about threatening the peace of Rome. This is about me following the God that I love. I am not here to overthrow an institution by force or intrigue. But yes, I am in conflict with my fellow Jews. But even then, we will agree on so many things. So let's step out of the narrative for a bit and have a little pause about the world in which we live. Because I would suggest that there's countless times when everybody in this building either has been or is currently or will be in the future in the dock for our faith and the things that we believe in. We'll be in the dock for following the way of Jesus, hopefully not in the same way that Paul appeared before Festus. but certainly maybe in the court of public opinion, on our front line. And maybe when we're in the dock, we will be confronted and have to deal with people as devious as Tertullus and Ananias and Drusilla and Felix, people who will spin the truth, people who might not want to listen to our way of thinking with an open mind, people who will twist the truth and do anything they can to kind of put us down. It could be at a strategic level when, as Christians, as followers of the way of Jesus, we will be criticized in the media, maybe in the way institutions in which we work are run. And that criticism and that challenge, like Tertullus, will be made out that what we believe is not a faith matter or a religious matter, but a political matter. That we stand out for the way society, however we define society, is currently thinks. How can you think in the way that you do as a follower of the way and say the things that you do? It's not the way we do things around here. And that somehow we can be a danger to society. At this level, sometimes it quite often baffles me that a faith that some would describe as irrelevant causes them to attack it so vehemently as a threat. If following the way of Jesus is irrelevant in today's world, then why are you attacking me like this? Why do you find it such a threat to you if, on the other hand, you say it's irrelevant? But in some ways, it's easy for us, or easier for us, to live with what's happening at that level. What is harder to live with is when, as is in case of Paul, it gets personal. When our friends put our faith in the dock. When our family puts our faith in the dock. When our husbands, wives, or children put our faith in the dock. When the people we genuinely love and pour our heart and our time and our care into put our faith in the dock. And it's in those times that maybe they don't respect our faith and they don't tell the truth and they won't even listen. And that is a very hard place to be. And in those times and in those situations and in those moments, it's easy to lash out and become emotional, to play them at their own game. I know this because I've been there. And when people criticize my faith and criticize the journey I'm on and criticize Jesus and say, how can you believe in this nonsense? They're criticizing the one that I love most deeply, who is so ingrained in part of who I am. That it's not just words, it cuts to the quick. And in those times, apart from being sad, and in those times, part of me just wants to lash out and play them at their own game. And sometimes those situations are a bit like that in basement cafe on a Friday night, when we're trying to love these kids in the best way that we can and share the love of Jesus in the best way we can. And sometimes their response is so hurtful and so painful that it's very easy to just lash out. But then that's not the way Paul did it. Paul didn't choose to fight fire with fire. Paul remained calm, he remained truthful, he remained honest, and he stuck to the facts. It's a difficult thing to do, but it's something we must learn to do. Because when we choose to become like our accusers, we lose control, and that is a weakness that they will exploit. So let's jump back into the narrative. Normally, after the prosecution and a defense, a case would be made, okay, the verdict would be made, and it would be quite quick. Job done. But Felix does something unusual. He adjourns the case. He annoys Ananias, but he adjourns the case. He could have made a verdict there and then, but instead he puts Paul under guard. Didn't send him to jail, didn't send him to execution. He kind of dillied and dallied and put him under guard, partly hoping for a huge bribe to release him. Felix is probably trying to play all sides. During his time under guard, Paul had an initial conversation with Felix and Drusilla, in which he not only talks about his faith, he says to Felix and Drusilla, the faith that I have actually should be shown in the way we live our lives. And he spoke directly against the kind of lifestyle that Felix and Drusilla were living at that time. And it says that Felix became troubled. Felix became actually quite troubled by the message that Paul was speaking directly into his life. because he was pointing out the wrong things in the way Felix was living, sent Paul away. But time and again over those 2 years, we're told other discussions happened. After 2 years, Felix was recalled to Rome to give an account of himself. Word had got to Rome that Felix perhaps wasn't the best governor of all time, and he was recalled. Festus was replaced. There's something of a repeat of what happened in Acts 24 before Paul is finally put on a boat and sent to Rome. Let's have a little look at these 2 years, because not a lot is said in Acts 24 about how these 2 years were spent. At first glance, it can seem like a waiting game. It can seem like Paul's mission has been put on hold. It can seem like 2 years frustrated. It can seem like 2 years of life wasted. Paul was kicking his heels under guard with a degree of freedom when really he wanted to be in Rome. So why wait 2 years? Sometimes we get into a way of thinking that there's a mechanical relationship between faithfulness and God's blessings. Paul had been faithful to God in standing up for him before Felix. Surely God would bless him by releasing him and sending him to Rome straight away. Isn't there a part of us that says, come on, Felix, do the right thing, do the decent thing, let Paul go? But God's ways are seldom our ways. God promised that Paul would stand before kings, and he would, but when the time was right. At least in these 2 years, God kept Paul safe. Under house arrest, he was safe. If Felix had released him onto the streets, who knew what the Jews would try next? Who knew what threat there might be next to Paul? So at least he kept him safe. But there was more than that. In these 2 years of confinement, Paul was given an opportunity that he otherwise would not have had. What a glorious opportunity to spend 2 years ministering God's love into a powerful governor and his wife, Drusilla. It doesn't seem that there was any immediate effect, but there was an amazing opportunity there to present the gospel to an influential Roman governor. Sometimes in our life, it can seem like life is on hold. Our opportunities to minister may seem limited in terms of our faith. It can seem like we're treading water. But even in those times, God will be at work, and we need to be alert to that. But also sometimes, as followers of Jesus, we can fall into a trap of thinking that ministry has to be controlled. Somehow it's formal, it's structured. We draw up programs and session plans. We try to create opportunities. We produce Gantt charts and carry out risk assessments. Well, perhaps not all of us, but I do. But so we kind of create this structure and say, there you are, God, go and breathe life into this. I have created sort of the perfect textbook children's or youth worker thing here. Breathe life into it, God. This is a platform to speak. But when we look at Acts 24, events seem more chaotic. They seem out of control, or at least unexpected. Paul's ministry seems terminated, his life in danger. But in a mix of wrong motives and sinful actions on behalf of others, God arranged for the gospel to be preached. All throughout, God was in control, although humanly it did not appear to be that way. Ministry can be about doing the right thing when everything around us seems to be going wrong. God is in control, even when the world seems out of control. Faith doesn't walk by sight, but by the assurance we have in God's persons and promises. This is where I want to start to draw things to the conclusion. We will all have times in our life when we try to follow the way of Jesus, when it seems that things seem to go wrong. We will all have times when our faith is tested to the limit. We will all have times when our hopes and our dreams seem a long way off and we just can't see a way out of our situation, and we can't see that those hopes and those dreams and those promises of God can ever come true. Sometimes we'll have those times when there doesn't seem to be a light at the end of the tunnel. Times when we've been following Jesus and enjoyed a sense of his presence, things have been going well, but now those times are tested. Times when we seem to be treading water. It may well be that those times have come about through relationships with others, people who challenge our beliefs, people who ridicule our faith, people who actively try and knock us off of course. There may even be times when we faithfully share our faith with others time and time again, and they seem so close to accepting Jesus in their life. Just as Paul ministered to Drusilla and Felix time and time again, but they still reject that faith. And so we question the power of the gospel message, and we hurt because the person we love, we want to share with our friends and the family, and they just don't get it. But here's the thing. Even in those times, God keeps his promises. God had made promises to Paul that he kept. And Paul did get to Rome eventually, despite all the plotting and scheming of his enemies. Despite the self-serving contrivances of Felix, God delivered on his promises. And he was with Paul in those 2 years of frustration. And Paul remained faithful to God. In the end, that's all any one of us can do. Whatever life throws at us, whatever we're going through now, is to trust in the promises of God, that he is always with us, and remain faithful to him. Maybe some of us are waiting on a promise from God right now. Maybe some of us are waiting and waiting. And it's hard, but all we can do is remain faithful and trust the one who made us and knows us better than anyone else. Let's pray. Father God, we thank you for the example of Paul. We thank you that despite the fact that in the world sense, everybody and everything and circumstances were all arranged and arrayed up against him, and yet he stood firm and he spoke the truth and he spoke about his love for you and his work for you and your work in his life, and he continued to minister your love to those that he met. And Lord, in those 2 years, I say thank you that you blessed him with that opportunity. You kept him safe and eventually set him off to Rome. So we thank you for that example. So pray for each one of us now that we will stand under the pressure when our faith is under attack, whatever the circumstances. Lord, for those of us who have friends and family who we dearly love and would love to share you with them, but Lord, sometimes they just turn around and attack us, and that hurts. Give us the strength to continue and the words to say. And Lord, for those of us that are waiting on a promise, for those of us where our faith seems to be just treading water and we can't see a way out, Lord, come close to us, speak to us, minister to us through the power of your Holy Spirit.